when you told me I wasn't right for you. It wasn't hard to believe, 'cause when I watched TV, I would never see a leading lady look like me. Familiar package with less pigment, I ain't ignorant, it's just reality.
There is this thing. Do you realize?
Consciousness is affected.
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Hello, it is just past 5 on Tuesday, February 27th. You're listening to CKUT broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. I'm Jules Bigel, and this is the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup. I'm going to be sharing some of the stories that I've been working on at the station with the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. First, that's going to be a rally outside of Mark Miller's office that took place last Wednesday, where people demanded the regularization of migrants' immigration status and permanent residency to everybody living in the country. Next, we have an interview with an artist who examines Vietnamese-Canadian identity and upends some of our expectations of what that might look like. Later on the show, you're going to hear about the ongoing hunger strike at McGill for Gaza, as well as a blockade of McGill's Bronfman building in protest of the university's complicity with the ongoing genocide. To wrap up, we're going to be having some coverage of Bill 31. It's a contentious housing bill that passed last week. Throughout the 8 or so months I've been at the station, I've been speaking to housing organizer after housing organizer about this bill. Now that it's finally law, we're going to be doing a bit of a retrospective to hear about all the problems people have highlighted with this contentious piece of legislation. But first, you're going to be hearing my interview with Amy Darriche from the Comité d'Action de Parc Extension and Solidarity Across Borders Montreal. Here's that clip now. Around 50 people gathered outside of Immigration Minister Mark Miller's constituency office last Wednesday to call for permanent status to all migrants living in Canada, documented or otherwise.
Status for?
All!
Status for?
All!
Status for?
All!
Last December, Miller announced he's working on a broad and comprehensive program that would allow many people living in Canada who lack valid documents to apply for permanent residency. This kind of program, which would regularize the status of thousands of migrants, was promised by the previous Minister of Immigration in a 2021 mandate letter. The Immigrant Worker Center and Solidarity Across Borders Montreal have been calling the government to implement a program ever since. Last week, that meant rallying outside the offices of each Montreal cabinet minister, including Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, to make sure that promise is upheld. CKUT spoke to Amy Darriche of the Comité d'Action de Parc Extension and Solidarity Across Borders Montreal about Wednesday's protest. Here's our conversation. So tell me a bit about the event today. You know, we're outside of Mark Miller's office by Lionel Grew Metro. What's going on?
So today's rally and speak out are taking place as part of a week of action for regularization. Members of Solidarity Across Borders and the Immigrant Worker Center have been visiting the offices of many ministers who are based in Montreal. I believe yesterday they were at Guilbeault's office, and they'll be visiting Trudeau tomorrow. We're here today as part of a contingent from Park Extension because it's become such a pressing issue that many tenants in Park X are facing. Many people can't defend their housing rights because they're worried that it might start a conflict with their landlord that would lead to a deportation. Others are not able to access services or not able to access decent work or income supports. We're here because we've come to the conclusion that there are no housing rights without status for all.
So, you know, people here are talking a lot about regularization. What exactly is regularization? What would a regularization program look like in practice?
So back in December, Immigration Minister Mark Miller said that he would be putting in place a regularization program as early as the spring. However, what he wasn't clear about is what this would look like. For us, we believe that this absolutely needs to be full permanent status for everybody, which is to say no sectoral permits, we regularize people from certain industries that we think are profitable. What we mean is everybody gets permanent residence without exceptions and without any exclusions.
And so you mentioned that this is affecting Park X in particular. I know that is a large immigrant population up there. One of the speakers talked about, you know, workplace abuses not being able to be reported. You mentioned tenants not being able to stand up for their rights. Just how common is this? Like, what is the sort of struggle that people will be facing if they don't have recourse to stand up for their rights?
We see it happening on pretty much a day-to-day basis. Many tenants come in facing different kind of abuses of their housing rights, but are uncertain if they can refuse an abusive rent hike or uncertain if they can challenge an eviction in some instances because their landlords are aware of their precarious status and they're worried about being reported. We see that a lot around workplace abuses too, that people are often paid way below the minimum wage or sometimes not paid at all, face harassment at the workplace and don't feel like they can report it. Another thing we've been seeing in Park X for the last 2 years is just a wave of people starting to get notices that to come into immigration because their deportation proceedings are happening. We talk a lot about gentrification in Park X, and it's compounded by this as well. Many of our neighbors are facing displacement from the neighborhood. It's not just because of evictions, it's deportations too.
Yeah, I think some people definitely look at this and say, well, you know, this, if we regularized everybody's status, we would have just an influx of migration that Canada can't deal with already, because immigration in the public eye by some politicians has been linked to the housing crisis. You know, how would you respond to that kind of rhetoric, which is, you know, growing way more common these days?
It's absolutely false. If you look at when the rents really started to go through the roof, that happened during the pandemic when the borders were effectively shut. This is something that a lot of opportunistic politicians are putting forth as a way of washing their hands of their own complicity in the housing crisis, as a way of turning away attention from their failure to properly invest in social housing, to implement rent control, to implement measures against evictions that would actually rein in the rents. We believe that it's absolutely necessary to counter this kind of discourse and to say loud and clear what we actually need is a greater investment on the federal and provincial level in social housing. What we need is rent control. What we need is an end to evictions. They need to stop blaming migrants.
on this regularization piece, you know, the Liberals are looking to put some kind of migration bill on the table. What can you tell me about that? What do you think is coming next year?
So we heard an announcement from Mark Miller back in December to this effect. It was obviously a glimmer of hope for many people who have been fighting for regularization for going on for about 3 years now, who've kept seeing this being delayed and delayed. We think it's obviously a reason to hope, but there's a lot that's uncertain. We don't know if this will be a full program, if they're going to start by sectors. What we are pushing for is that it absolutely needs to be a full, complete, inclusive regularization program for everybody.
And that's why you're out here today, basically.
That's why we're out here today.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jules.
Open the door. Seek new world. In here, Security 90.3 FM from Montreal.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
I hear you loud and clear.
All right. So we are live on air. We're just doing a little bit of an interview about a new art exhibition, Hybrid Condition, that is launching later this week. Can I just get you to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Cam Quavu. I'm an artist in Montreal. I'm Vietnamese-Canadian. And like Jules said, I'm exhibiting a work in the vernissages this week.
Yeah, so... Hybrid Condition is your first solo exhibition, I know. Congrats, first of all.
Thank you.
So let's just, start with that name. What is a hybrid condition? When you talk about that, what exactly do you mean?
The hybrid condition, I guess you have to go to the exhibition to find out. Just kidding.
Touché.
But yeah. But it's really talking about this dual identity that as... many other Vietnamese Canadians or Vietnamese diaspora or even anybody else mixed experiences where at once you might feel a belonging to your, or for me personally, to Vietnam, and but also having been born in Quebec, also being Canadian. You know, when I'm in Canada, the first thing I think physically about me is that I'm Asian or Vietnamese, and I can feel othered immediately. Whereas in Vietnam, racially and physically, I blend in, except, I do dress quite strangely, and that gives me out. But you wouldn't know that I'm an outsider until I start speaking and having these sorts of different thoughts. And so, you know, you have this challenge in finding a belonging, whether you're neither from here nor there.
Yeah. When you say you dress strangely, are you like dressing like a Montrealer? Is there something, you know, specifically Montreal about your style, or is it just your own unique spin on things?
I wear like old granny clothing, you know, just like the matching pant and top is just so fresh, and so I wear this. Yeah, definitely not. I mean, you might also stand out as a Milander from 10 years ago and present day, actually.
Yeah, that's funny you say that. I feel like that also really describes my style, granny clothing. We can bring it back. but I guess in your artist statement, you know, you talk about challenging common representations and depictions of, you know, both Vietnamese and Vietnamese-Canadian identity. What are those common representations? Like, how do you feel like those identities have been sort of read or stylized in the public?
Yeah, I think, like, I can rattle off a list of movies that represent, or, like, Western movies Hollywood movies that depict Vietnamese bodies, you know, like Apocalypse Now, Full Metal Jacket, Deer Hunter, Forrest Gump. It's just, it goes on, but a lot of these movies are just Vietnamese people as background actors, and then let alone it's all war films. And so a lot of what I'm presenting in this work is also Asian and Vietnamese self-representation outside of what the media shows us in that way. And that's like a very simplistic example. You know, there's also other more nuanced ways that the media depicts Asian bodies and Vietnamese bodies in the way that the news talks about Asian bodies and Vietnamese bodies. And so I really put focus on this footage in the exhibition in many layers.
Yeah, the footage meaning kind of this mainstream footage, and you're twisting it or you're commenting on it?
Yeah, so I'm montaging it and assembling it, and I'm using a technique called Pepper's Ghost, where you almost have this holographic or hologram effect in the space. And so I layer the videos on top of each other using this technique. And so once you'll be able to see this very stereotypical footage, and then also I've spliced in my own footage over top. And so what you get is, a layering of videos.
Yeah, so, you know, you talk about this layering technique for multimedia video exhibition, but, you know, what are some of the other mediums that you're putting into the show? I know that's not all that's there. It's a sort of, yeah, I guess, multimedia experience, right?
Yeah, I think the main primary room has this four-screen exhibition that you mentioned, but... And also at the start of this interview, we talked about how this is my first solo exhibition. And while it is, it's not entirely done solo and not entirely solo. I've asked a couple of artists from Vietnam or a Vietnamese-Norwegian artist to contribute. And so there's a sound component to the installation. And also there's a couple of sculptures throughout. And all of this contributes to the immersiveness of the space and feeling this hybrid condition. People will take away what they take away from it, but my intention really is for you to walk into this space, have maybe 10% of what I feel when I'm experiencing my life in Canada or experiencing my life in Vietnam. And do you know the movie Blade?
I wish I could say I did. Especially now that you say it's a vampire movie, I'm like, damn.
Maybe some of the listeners do, but there's a scene in the beginning where these vampires bring in an unsuspecting human into a party, a rave, a dark party, and after a while, the music starts to pick up and the vampires devour this human. And it's, you know, it's a 90s movie. So there's leather trench coats and this 90s techno type of music, but it's very much this feeling that I want to induce within the space. But also I say all this, there's some imagery of trauma and pains and things, but there's also really beautiful imagery. There's joy, depictions of joy and love and friendship. Also, just to show a nuance or a multiplicity of identity, or that we as a hybrid, you also have, you know, a multitude of feelings as everybody else does also.
Yeah, I love this image you're putting forward. So you want the people who go into the show to be devoured by
in a way, yeah.
Love and friendship and trauma and, you know, all these complicated emotions.
All of it, exactly. And the screens are running on opposite runtimes or separate runtimes. So as it loops, the videos or the experience that you have will be different than somebody that goes a week later.
Yeah. So, you know, sort of to wrap up, what has the process of creation been like? I know that you have a residency right now. How has it been to, collaborate with other artists and put on the show as your first sort of, your first show where you have kind of final say on everything that's going on in the space?
Yeah, it's been amazing. I'm currently actually at the Prim Center in Ushlaga, finishing the work right now as we speak. So that's fun. Working with other artists has been great. I mean, my background is in design and production managing and project management. So these sorts of things, or managing timelines, is a little bit of my forte, in the way that I can give out all the work to everyone and I can be the bottleneck, grinding away at the project at the final hour, the 11th inning here.
Wow. It's really not every artist that can say that, project management is their forte. So congrats for
that. That's exactly it. Thank you. Yeah, you can come see the exhibition. Hope to see you at the Vernissage on Thursday.
Oh, yeah. So there's the Thursday Vernissage. The exhibition runs for a month, and you're giving a couple guided tours. That's right, eh?
Yeah, I'm giving a couple guided tours. There's going to be one in English and French and Vietnamese. And my website should have all of that information. And I'll be hanging out at the space a little bit until March 18th, and I fly to Vietnam. So maybe if you catch me, I'll give you the off-the-cuff artist walkthrough.
Okay, wow. So anybody listening to CKUT, you can take that offer up if you are able to catch the artist in person. But thanks so much for joining us on air. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
All right, you can catch Hybrid Condition all throughout March, Tuesday through Saturday, at MAI, Montreal Art Interculturel, at 3680 Jean Mons. The Vernissage is this Thursday from 5 to 8 p.m. And you're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to CKUT, and the following is a story done by one of our volunteers in the news department. That's Wendy Zhao. If you're interested in getting involved in our growing news collective at CKUT, you can email spokenword@ckud.ca. And you can join our collective, which puts on a show the first Friday of every month. That's Off the Hour Fridays. And folks are out there doing grassroots community news. We've got workshops for anybody interested in producing that themselves. So Wendy went to the Bronfman Building on McGill campus this past Thursday for an action by Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, a student group at McGill, as well as other allied groups on campus. They were boycotting and blockading the Bronfman Building, which is with the management faculty, because of a specific course in which students at McGill traveled to Israel to learn about the entrepreneurship and startup culture. But the university they're at and the companies they're hearing about are complicit in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And that's what you're about to hear about. Take a listen.
On Thursday, February 22nd, a coalition of students and student groups blocked all entrances to the Bronfman Building from 8 a.m. until building closure in protest of Desotel's exchange program called the Startup Nation.
the Startup Nation like mantra. It's like essentially like it's supposed to normalize like the state of Israel as this like new like up and coming booming nation, and it completely like erases like the history of genocide and Israeli occupation. So that's what we're targeting today. That's why the Zetel faculty was the target.
Nobody successfully crossed the picket line the entire day, and CKUT spoke to some of the picketers on the scene.
We're here as a coalition of student groups, so including SPHR McGill, IJV, Divest, members of AXEM, and grad students for Palestine. And essentially over 70 students have shut down the Bronfman building to reiterate once again that there will be no business or classes as usual during the ongoing genocide that has killed over 30,000 Palestinians. We have shut down the Dizotel Faculty of Management specifically today because it has a long history of complicity. It's complicit since it hosts an exchange program with Israel, including the Startup Ecosystem Trip, which goes to the Hebrew University. And this university actually works closely with the Zionist military, developing their weapons and strategies of terrorism to be used against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza.
Here's another student who was at the shutdown. They were handing out flyers about the Faculty of Education's complicity in funding genocide.
I'm an undergrad student in the Faculty of Education, and I'm here with Education Students for Palestine and Recess Collective, and I'm here today because we believe in divestment on campus, and because our faculty in particular accepted a $30 million donation from a Zionist billionaire 2 years ago and has used that money to establish a partnership with Tel Aviv University, which legitimizes the settler state of so-called Israel. Research the Sylvan Adams Sports Science Institute, and if you don't like it, please raise awareness about it and let the Faculty of Education know that you will not let that whole operation go uninhibited. We have a lot of Zionist faculty, and our department has not said a single thing about 5,000 school children having been murdered by a military force backed by the U.S. So we're in the process of organizing right now, but we have experienced censorship in the department, coming from the dean's office in particular.
Another student shared their experience with faculty and students who tried to cross the picket line.
Like, we've had people lunge at children, like, around. We've had people grab our, like, protesters. We've had, like, faculty members and students. I mean, like, it's just, like, it's honestly disgusting.
So today, actually, the Board of Governors are meeting, and the Board of Governors is responsible precisely in investing $20 million in companies that profit off of the occupation of our land, but also companies like Elbit Systems, Lockheed Martin, Thales, and Safran, who manufacture the very weapons being used to murder and genocide Palestinians with impunity. Our university has taken a very clear pro-Zionist and pro-genocide stance, and the students have evidently and democratically articulated that they refuse to have their tuition money misused to bankroll Zionist crimes, and that they stand with the struggle for liberation no matter what.
We're keeping the momentum alive. Like, join the student movement. Like, it's not over. There's so much complicity around us. We're students in an institution that has disgusting, like, ties with Israel. And, like, so long as we are here, like, you have a duty to, like, consistently show up for Palestine. We just have to make ourselves unavoidable at this point, and we will continue to do so past today.
All right, that was a story by Wendy Zhao in our news collective at CKUT 90.3 FM. Up next, you're going to be hearing an interview that I did on the show last week about an ongoing hunger strike on McGill campus in protest of McGill's complicity in the occupation and genocide in Gaza. McGill invests $20 million in companies tied to the genocide and illegal settlements on Palestinian lands. Take a listen. You're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bigel. It's been just over 4 months since October 7th. In those 4 months, almost 30,000 people have died in Gaza, according to estimates from their Ministry of Health. Now, Israel has launched a bombardment campaign of Rafah, a sanctuary and refugee camp in the south of Gaza, where over 1 million people have fled. It may feel like a long way away from Montreal, But students at McGill say that the university's ties to companies operating in Israel and the West Bank, and to academic institutions on those lands as well, make McGill complicit. That's why they've launched a hunger strike. Starting Monday, around a dozen students on McGill campus will get their sustenance from liquids, things like broth, water, and coffee, in protest of McGill's refusal to implement BDS, that's boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I speak with two of the hunger strikers, who go by the names Rox and Emma. This is for their safety, as this kind of pro-Palestinian activism is often met with doxing and recrimination. They joined me in studio at CKUT, but you can find them on McGill campus, outside the James Administration Building, or in the Red Path Library on the first floor. Here's our conversation.
Hi, you can call me Rox, and that's that.
Yes, hi. For the purpose of this interview, I'll be going by Emma. We're both students at McGill.
Yeah, can you tell me, just, you know, in broad strokes, what are you in strike over? What's going on this week?
Well, it's going to go on for as long as the demands aren't met, and the demands are maybe for to some not simple, but for us it is pretty simple. We want a full divestment, and we want an academic boycott to be put in place, and we want McGill to honor those demands, and so we are on hunger strike until those demands are met.
We have indefinite hunger strikers, so people who are not stopping until the demands are met. But we also have relay hunger strikers for students who want to do just a few days at a time and to get as much support as possible. And of course, we have a bunch of students helping us. We have a care team, outreach team.
Yeah. And in terms of the hunger strike itself, are you guys both on indefinite or are you on the relay strike?
Me personally, I'm an indefinite striker, so I haven't been eating since before midnight on February the 19th. So I haven't been eating for, close to 48 hours now.
I am currently doing care work and managing a bit with the socials, and I'm hoping to go on an indefinite hunger strike soon enough myself as well.
I know that you're drinking water and broth as well to, you know, make sure that you don't collapse. But this is a really huge decision and a huge step. I'm wondering if you both can tell me about, you know, how it got to this point where the McGill administration has been so resistant to boycott and divestment efforts that, you felt that this was the step to take.
Well, basically, there's been protests on campus for years now. There's been efforts for years now to raise awareness about the apartheid in Palestine and occupied Palestine, with the genocide that started, that we should say intensified on October 7th. These efforts were ramped up. There was a referendum passed where 78% of undergraduate students voted for a policy against genocide, which included asking our administration to fully divest and to academically boycott Israeli apartheid, just like we did with South Africa back in 1986. And just now in February, graduates also overwhelmingly voted at the PGSS for a similar policy, again, asking for administration to meet these demands. And so it's reached a point where students have clearly asked for it, or there's been protests on campus. There's been all sorts of groups on campus that have showed support and solidarity, but our administration ignores us. And given the urgency of the situation, given that children are without food, water, humanitarian aid, electricity, right now, all throughout Gaza, given that there's about 10,000 Palestinians that are currently held hostage in a military court, given that this apartheid has been going on for many decades now, we felt that it was an appropriate action to take to put our bodies on the line and to do so in solidarity with the Palestinians undergoing the genocide right now in order to get results as soon as possible from our administration.
Yeah, and I know that you have a statement, right, from a Palestinian student who is involved in your campaign that you were looking to share. You know, maybe now is a time to make that heard as well.
Yes, okay. So we have a statement from the student. As a Palestinian McGill student with family in Gaza, I have been having an extremely difficult time with my studies. On my way to a midterm exam in the fall, I received a phone call from my mother telling me that my cousin and his two young daughters, ages 7 and 5, were killed in an airstrike in Khan Yunis. Needless to say, I performed poorly on the exam. This was not helped by the countless emails by the McGill administration, both supporting Israel's occupation and demonizing Palestinian advocacy on campus. I no longer felt safe on campus. McGill's $20 million investments in the Israeli occupation and the genocide of my family and people. It is not ethical to continue paying tuition at McGill. Like any student, I just want to get an education. I also don't want my education to be funding a genocide, especially when it is a genocide that has killed over 25 members of my family, all within the safe zones of Gaza, safe zones in quotation. I am participating in the hunger strike because we have exhausted all our options when it comes to demanding the McGill administration to stop their funding and support of a genocidal occupation. We as students will be heard and will be taken seriously. My family in Gaza have not eaten in 4 months. They are starving. McGill is paying. It is time for us to starve in solidarity. It feels wrong for us to eat while Palestinians are starving. And McGill is investing $20 million annually to keep them hungry.
What jumps out at me, I mean, among the many things in that statement, is this $20 million figure, right? And this is what BDS is all about, is boycott institutions who have ties to Israel, especially academic. D is for divest, right? These investments in Israeli companies or companies that are, you know, operating in illegal settlements, and then sanctions, which is sort of outside of what McGill can do, though, you know, if it took a strong stance, obviously that could count as a sanction. Can you tell me more about the kinds of ties, you know, those $20 million, those academic exchanges, that are the exact thing that is prompting you to go on this hunger strike?
Yes. Some of this has already been outlined previously. We're not the ones who came up with these this list of companies. For example, McGill invests $515,000 in Lockheed Martin, a weapons manufacturer, in Airbus Aerospace, Thales SA, $1.5 million and $1.6 million respectively. These are all weapon manufacturing companies. There are others such as RBC, which has itself shares in mass surveillance system that provides AI tools to the Israeli military. So all these different companies, whether directly or indirectly, are supporting the current apartheid and the current genocide of Palestinians. We also on our list have these four universities: Ben-Gurion University, Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Technion Israel Institute of Technology, and Tel Aviv University. So to different extents, these universities either heavily invest in research and development for the Israeli military, or they've themselves participated in occupying land by literally building their universities upon Palestinian land that's not supposed to be within Israel. So, yeah, these are some of the academic ties. And one more I would mention is that we have these two classes in Organic Bio and Desatel Faculty of Management. It's kind of the same class but combined. It's the Comparing Startup Ecosystems, and in the Faculty of Engineering, Building a Winning Business Plan, so FAC 501, Org 434, and Finance 434. These are all basically contribute to what's called tech washing, where technology is considered as this neutral force of progress, when in reality, this technology is being developed to further the oppression of Palestinians. So these are sort of some of the ties that we would like for our university to cut.
Yeah, and the line has sort of been that they just want a safe and respectful discourse on campus, this kind of like neutrality, right, from the administration. And that's why they're saying, you know, they can't do any kind of BDS, although they recently divested from the top 200 like carbon emission fossil fuel companies. So there is a kind of divestment that's possible on campus. In light of what you've just said, what would your response be to that kind of argument?
I would say that there's not really such a thing as neutrality in these types of things, right? Like if you were on the street and you were watching somebody get stabbed, right? If you stood there and did nothing, you would not be neutral. You would be complicit. How is this any different? How have we allowed ourselves to be removed so much from people and from the world that we are, you know? And it's not neutral, right? Because neutral would be not being involved at all. But there is involvement. There's a financial involvement. There's normalization ties with academic involvement. So even that neutrality is a mirage. It's an illusion. It's not really neutral.
And I'd like to also add that you mentioned the fossil fuels example, the big win that we had, 50 million just last semester. There's also the example of 1986, when we got McGill to divest from South African apartheid, and it was 50 million at the time, which adjusted to inflation today is about 140 million. So in fact, this was a much larger number. And so we think that 20 million is possible. And not only that, it's a not only is it possible, it's a question of when and not if it's going to happen, and we want to make it happen now.
I hear that, and especially the South African divestment that happened, as far as I know, pretty quickly from when the campaign was started. But this has been a long time that the administration has been refusing to even hear questions of BDS. You know, they have threatened to withdraw money from the student society, basically, if they ratify votes in favor of BDS on that level. Even fossil fuel divestment, like, it took over a decade since the campaign was started for McGill's Board of Governors to actually agree to divest. So, you know, it looks like an uphill battle. Just on the level of your campaign, I'm curious about, you know, how many people are involved, and if you can tell me more about what you have in place to keep each other safe during this.
So right now we have a dozen people, I would say, who are actively involved and heavily involved, right? We also have other people who are joining us, and we're very happy to have the support pouring in. And there's a lot of things that we are doing to keep people safe and secure, just in terms of, like, health for, say, the indefinite hunger strikers. We're heavily recommending that people, you know, get medical checks and make sure they have support, which is why some people are starting a bit later. We ask also that they fill a form where they acknowledge the risks and they understand what they are taking on, the responsibility that they are taking on. We also make sure to have a care team, as we talked about earlier, I believe. So the care team is there to support the people who are hunger striking on campus as they go around to keep them safe from harassment, from violence, and also just in case they faint. And for any reasons, we try to keep a support system and a network. And, you know, we are independent students. We are functioning on our own, but we do try to build a sort of community where people can rely on each other and help each other.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, the threat of harassment and violence. Have you guys faced harassment? I know you've been outside the James Administration Building and in Red Path Library, you know, especially the latter location. There's a lot of through traffic there. What is the response that you've been getting from the on-campus community?
In general, I think we've gotten a lot of positive feedback, overwhelmingly positive feedback, but there have been some exceptions from the work that we started doing. Online, we got a couple creepier messages. For example, when we started hunger strike, people asking, will there be food at the event? We got literally spat on yesterday, or during our first sit-in in front of the administration building.
And today as well.
Oh.
This happened 2 days in a row. We don't know if it's the same person, really. This has happened twice. They go by really quickly and just spit on us and go. Sorry.
But no, that's like kind of hard to imagine, but it's like good to talk about, because I think most people wouldn't probably believe that anyone would treat anybody else like that, even, you know, despite this difference in opinion. But I guess, you know, you say it's been overwhelmingly positive. I've heard that you have also heard from McGill administration. What has that response been like?
Essentially, we sent them an email telling them that students have been asking for this and we are going on hunger strike, informing them of our hunger strike. And almost immediately the next day, so yesterday, we got a response from them telling us that well, you know, we have a right to express ourselves, we should worry about our safety, but they'd like to meet, come sit down and meet with us. And we've sort of come to the conclusion, and this hasn't been announced yet, but we don't think that we would like to meet them behind closed doors under any circumstances. We think that if there's a meeting, it should be a public meeting, that all the pro-Palestine groups on campus, or even all students, should be invited, because this is a public concern, because a majority of students have already voted in support of a policy, a divest and boycott policy. So we're just part of that movement, and we would like for all students to be there if there's any meetings at all. We would like for all them to be public. And also just because any closed door conversation that might happen will inevitably benefit the authority, right? That's always how it works. It weakens democratic movements. Any closed door negotiations, backdoor negotiations, weaken democratic movements and benefit those in authority, giving them an upper hand. So we will not meet with them unless it's a public meeting open to all.
All right, that was an excerpt of an interview with Rox and Emma, two hunger strikers with a campaign to stop McGill from investing in companies complicit in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. You can learn more about their campaign online through their link tree. But we're going to close out the hour with a little retrospective on Bill 31, which passed just last week at Quebec's National Assembly after months and months of contestation. Have a listen.
En fait, au mois de juin, le gouvernement a annoncé qu'ils allaient mettre en place un nouveau projet de loi sur le logement, en pleine crise du logement. Contrairement à ce qu'on pouvait s'attendre, en fait, c'est une loi juste pour les propriétaires et propriétaires, notamment avec l'abolition du droit de cession de bail pour les locataires. C'est-à-dire que jusqu'à maintenant, les locataires pouvaient céder le bail entre eux et elles et par la même occasion garder le logement hors marché, ce qui permettait de contrôler les hausses de loyers abusives qu'on voit en ce moment.
Well, the bill first, the main problem with the bill is that it does not address in any way all the problems that are related to the housing crisis. It doesn't act upon the explosion of rents that we're seeing in Quebec year over year. It does not address properly the multiplication of evictions that has been happening recently. So this is the main problem with this bill. But also, on top of that, you have a bill that is removing rights from tenants, which is the lease transfer.
Quebecers have held the right to transfer a lease since the 1970s, and it's the abolition of lease transfers contained in Bill 31 that people are worried about the most. Initially used as a way to let tenants off the hook if they needed to leave a lease early, needed to move cities, things like that. Now lease transfers are often used to keep rents low in between tenants, and they're one of the last tools, people say, to keep the rent down in a hot rental market in the province.
Well, lease transfer are at this point one of the few tools we have to guarantee affordability in rent. So rent, market rate rents are extremely high for a community with high immigrant and low-income population of Park X. The market rate is just too high. It's no longer affordable. So lease transfers are a way to assure that if someone's paying a low rent, they can transfer that onto someone who's coming in.
In Quebec, we have a lot of protections already. Like, compared to other provinces, we're really fortunate, but that's because we fought so much in the past for our rights to be so strong. And Bill 31 wants to take away our right to lease transfers, which is unacceptable. It's going to be disastrous because it's our only tool right now to fight the housing crisis. It's all we've got left, and to take it away is just unthinkable.
And we were talking about the first removal of rights from tenants in over 45 years, probably ever in the history of tenants' rights in Quebec. So this is the current context. This is unacceptable, and I think this is why we're seeing such a widespread anger and indignation. Is that it's not just the bill itself. It's that in the current context, you have a government that is not only not addressing the situation, but even it's also removing rights from tenants.
People's feelings about this issue are often very personal. They're seeing their own rents skyrocketing year after year, sometimes above the rate of inflation. And even though there are protections in Quebec against these rising rents, they're often hard to make use of, especially in between tenants.
You know, even within the last 5 years, I mean, you talk to any tenant and they can tell you that they're almost paying, you know, sometimes double the rent that they used to pay. And that's certainly my experience. When I moved to Montreal, I was renting a room for $400, and in the same neighborhood, it can be difficult to find something for under $800 now. So there's definitely that aspect. And then as well as someone who used to work in tenants' rights advocacy, you know, we just see, you know, just a general degradation of people's access to housing, of people having to make greater and greater concessions to landlords to even access it, whether it be financial or with their personal information or even just with intrusive landlords who demand far too much of them.
Moi, j'ai la chance de vivre en HLM, alors ça n'a pas vraiment changé, mais je connais des gens où le loyer a augmenté un 3,5 à 1300. Alors, 1300 pour un 3,5, une famille n'y loge pas. Des trois chambres à coucher à 1800, ils n'ont pas les moyens. Les personnes vulnérables, ce sont les personnes âgées, mais les jeunes familles sont très vulnérables parce que les parents monoparentaux avec des enfants vont faire quoi avec son salaire minimum ou l'aide sociale?
Park X is it's facing the housing crisis like every other neighborhood, and it's gotten worse with the arrival of the Compass Mill. We're seeing gentrification in the neighborhood happening in an accelerated rate. We're seeing hundreds of cases every year of evictions. People are being forced out of the places they've stayed for a long time. We're seeing people who've been there for 20, 30 years saying, now you have to leave because now the landlords want to... Sometimes the new landlords coming in, they see a way to make profit, or the old landlords are like, just now realize they have a way to make more money, so they're kicking out their old tenants. And these are a lot of people that then don't have other places to stay. This is a community that is identified with a strong immigrant communities, and it's a neighborhood that is often seen as the first neighborhood you come in. So affordability is the big reason why it was such a welcoming neighborhood. And without that, Park X loses its identity in a way.
Montreal vastly underestimates the importance of affordable housing, that it is such a key player to establishing a rich cultural community here. The fact that there's such a vastly rich artistic, music, visual arts, that is the result of decades of affordable housing. And if we lose affordable housing for tenants, the problems that is going to create is multifold. That it is the last social safety net for people. And if we lose that, then the city's going to have much bigger problems on its hands.
In a province where there actually is such a high proportion of renters, this is the difference at this point between having access to a home and being on the street. And people are increasingly they're having to be on the street because they can't afford rent.
And
in a province where there actually is such a high proportion of renters, this is the difference at this point between having access to a home and being on the street. And people are increasingly they're having to be on the street because they can't afford rent.
But the impact of the bill will be felt far beyond Montreal.
This is probably the worst housing crisis that we've been seeing in modern Quebec, because it's really completely widespread. There is no region that is not affected. The vacancy rates are lower outside of city centers. The rents are raising faster outside of city centers. So basically, there's no way out for tenants anywhere in the province to find affordable housing.
The CAQ's solution to the housing crisis has been to build within the private market. The only problem is they're axing other ways of protecting tenants during one of the worst crises Quebec has ever seen. 2 years ago, the CAQ ended Accès Logis, Quebec's only social housing fund. Instead, they've replaced it with the FAC, a program that incentivizes affordable housing as well as social housing. But the focus is really on the former, market rate-based housing, with a little bit of a discount, instead of fully socialized non-market housing. This would be enough to have housing workers up in arms, but with Bill 31, they've gone one step further.
One of the biggest things in PL 31 that a lot of folks aren't talking about is that in the law it says that the SHQ, la Société d'habitation du Québec, that's like the governmental entity that oversees a lot of the social housing and the housing subsidy programs that we have, would have the right to alienate, so isolate, low-income housing, the HLMs as we call them, and put them up for sale to the private market to be able to bring in more profits to build other HLMs. What we know from that desire, from that amendment to the law, from the potentiality of what that could do is we're going to end up with even less low-income housing than we already have. And it's all going to go to the private market, and that's going to create an ecosystem of tension and rage and anger amongst people that are poor and working class to bring back this program. So if anything, the CAC, François Legault, and Madame Duranceau are creating a pressure cooker that they themselves cannot defuse.
The devil is in the details with this bill. They are, with Bill 31, opening up subsidies to the private sector. They've completely cut Accès Logis, which was the only program in Quebec dedicated to social housing, replacing it with a program called the FAC that has abordable in the name, affordable. It's new, and no one quite knows exactly how it's going to work. I'm not sure they know. But what we do know is that subsidies will be open to the private sector. And that's the reasoning, right? They were like, we need to build more housing, but we don't want to be Toronto, we're going to have a bunch of luxury homes. I mean, they're not really luxury homes. They're just regular apartments, but they're at luxury prices. And that's what we'll see with this. We know that.
I mean, what we're looking at is just total disengagement from the provincial government of their responsibility to provide housing to their citizens, including social housing. You know, it almost feels like a joke at times, the way that the housing minister has completely disregarded the less than wealthy in this province and in Montreal. We've seen just increased, you know, lack of interest, lack of funding, and just also overt neglect of the buildings that exist. You know, I've seen buildings that have bed bugs and infestations so bad that the government literally says they can't resolve them. So we're looking at a very dire situation for people who cannot afford expensive rent, which is honestly the majority of Quebecers. So it's completely, you know, just a complete disconnection from the reality of tenants in Quebec.
Housing Minister France-Elaine Duranceau has come under fire for her connections to developers and landlords. She's taken meetings with the CORPIC, Quebec's Landlord Association, while refusing them with tenants groups. She's also a former developer herself, who was sanctioned by the Ethics Commissioner of the National Assembly for favoring an old developer friend and former business partner in an abusive fashion.
The housing minister who's introducing this bill, who's proposing this bill, her interests lie with the real estate agent friends that she was a part of before she became a housing minister. I don't know how she got this job, but it doesn't feel appropriate to me to assign someone with that background, with those interests, to represent those of tenants, because really, it's supposed to be about protecting us, that position.
Well, I think the number of news reports that came out, the minister's own conflict of interest, sort of demonstrated where her allegiance lie. And like, since she was a former real estate agent, the landlords have been, and their associations and their representatives have been for ages wanting to fight lease transfer. There was a court decision in the early 2000s that guaranteed lease transfer, and since then it's been like on their list. They want to get rid of lease transfer, and now they have a government that's favorable to their concerns.
But people in housing say the problems aren't just with Duranceau's direct connections to developers, real estate agents, and landlords. The issue also pertains to the way that housing is seen as a for-profit good.
To see housing and the housing crisis as just a matter of supply and demand is completely false. It's been demonstrated in various international studies. The main problem is that, of course, the housing, addressing the housing supply, it's a long-term solution, first. Second is that when you're relying mostly on the private sector, even if you build more, it will only have an adverse effect on the explosion of rents. First, because what is built is always more expensive. The rents are always more expensive. And second, because in Quebec especially, there is a total lack of control because of a specific clause, the clause F, that is allowing landlords to raise the rents the way they want in the first 5 years of construction of the building. So, and we can see that. We can see that in places where you have more newer building being constructed. This has an impact on the explosion of rents, and this is throughout the province.
Every day, when you hear these conversations about the so-called housing crisis and the supply and demand, the issue is depoliticized. It's presented as this some sort of technical issue. The levers are not right. We need to calibrate the policies. And if you only get the policy mix right, we're going to arrive at some sort of equilibrium in the market. All of this conversation is not only highly inaccurate from a purely research perspective, because you can take a lot of these pieces into pieces from a both a theoretical and from a data and from an analytical perspective. But most importantly, it depoliticizes houses. Time and again, we put in place policies that are deliberately making housing profitable, that ensure high returns on investment. And then I get on the radio at 7 o'clock in the morning before having enough caffeine, and people ask me, how come it's unaffordable? I was like, what is this unaffordable?
You know, it's easy to say, I'll just be like us, just be like the point. But at the end of the day, what we're gonna really need in this country is a program that invests a massive amount of funds into the construction of new social housing units, but more importantly, the ability for the provincial, the federal, or even the municipal government to rip away private housing from private landlords, right? If you're a landlord and you have 6 buildings, right? And you run them like you're a baron, and you harass tenants, you bring them to court, you make their lives a living hell, the federal government, which is paid by our taxpayer dollars, which is mandated to help us as working class people, should be allowed to go and rip that unit away from them and socialize that building. What we need right now, and this you'll see every social housing group, every tenants' rights group agree on this, we need to be able to remove private housing stock and socialize it en masse. It's the only way we can do it. We can't wait 10 years to build 6 giant high-rises. We need right now a machine